Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Devron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the third week of March. This week, we are very happy to take a wander along the coast with geologist Varn Brooks, a field trip that I wanted to take with Varn for ages. Varn's an avid naturalist with a specialty in geology and also a really great photographer. And he's been especially keyed into the coastal geology of our area since moving to live above the beach near Cape George. Welcome, Varn.
Good morning, and thank you.
We're really happy to have you, and we have this beautiful, calm day, sunny and calm, which is rare by the beach. So we're really happy to have you. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this a cool sound? A big hint for it is that it is something that you might hear from the beach if you are very lucky. We should probably start with a few comments about our field location. We're meeting on the beach near the Cape George Marina because it's the beach closest to Varn and Karen's home, and it's the coastal area that Varn knows best. But this access point is not open to the general public, but it can be accessed from North Beach at a low tide, and the things that we're going to speak about are common to many of our coastal areas in Port Townsend and in Washington. So, Varn, as we look at the view of Protection Island from Cape George, can you give us an overview of what we're seeing?
So as we look at the view from here, we're seeing a landscape shaped by ice and water. When we look at Protection Island, we see this nice kind of smooth flowing landscape on the top surrounded by bluffs. If we look across at the Miller Peninsula, we see the same thing. And if you're in Port Townsend and looking across at Whidbey Island, you see a similar scene where the tops of the islands, Marrowstone Island and Whidbey, are a fairly smooth but flowing surface. And that surface, at the end of the Pleistocene, as the ice was here, that surface was the ramp that the ice actually moved down. So if you're standing almost anywhere on the North Quimper Peninsula and you look behind you, you see that same smooth flowing surface. If you drive up the valleys of south of Port Townsend, you'll see that these are the valleys were scoured by the ice as it moved by. And at the end of the Pleistocene, when the ice was still here, that was all a continuous surface. So you could have walked from Whidbey Island across to Marrowstone or to Port Townsend. That surface would have been all one surface. As the ice moved south, it formed that ramp. It came down like a bulldozer, and it just formed that surface. So that continuous surface covered the whole area. And at the end of the Pleistocene, when you think about the glacier.
And the Pleistocene again was, it ended about, 11,000?
About 10 to 11,000 years ago when this was happening. So as the ice moves south, it's moving from a large continental glacier. So the continental glacier was much longer lived, and the ice is pushing south from there. As the ice, this big mass of ice north of us pushed the ice south, the ice itself moves and it's melting as it goes. So as the ice moved south down through the lowlands over the islands, formed this ramp. It pushed the material ahead of it, and it leveled the ground. It formed this ramp that you see on the skyline around you. Then when the ice begins to melt back, when the glacier recedes, the ice doesn't move back. The ice just stays where it is and melts.
Uh-huh.
So we have this big block of ice now that's melting and breaking up. Water gets trapped in it. We have ice dams and floods, and all of this water draining back through the broken ice at the end of the glacier that cuts the low ground, and the water moves back into these lower areas.
So just to review for me and our radio audience, that big block of ice, I mean that big glacier that came from the north, did it run into the Olympic Mountains? Did it stop just about there and
right.
then receded back?
Right. So what happened was there was a huge amount of ice that moved by here. And as the ice came down from the north, it stalled out against the Olympic Mountains or met the Olympics. And about at Protection Island, the ice turned and it flowed to the west. And that's where the huge bulk of the ice moved. But another arm of the ice moved south down the Puget Lowlands, and it made it about as far south as Olympia. And at about Olympia, now the ice that flowed out toward the Pacific, because sea level was quite a bit lower than it is today, 300 and some feet lower, so the Pacific was quite a bit further out to the west. But that ice probably flowed all the way into seawater, like the glaciers you see in Alaska or Greenland today that come right down to sea level and calve into the sea. But the Puget tongue of the glacier went south towards Olympia, and that never reached the sea. It was melting back, and the water that ran off the toe of it drained south of the Olympics, down into the Chehalis River. So,
Varn, when the glacier moves down, it kind of advances like a bulldozer, and it's being pushed by all this weight of the ice, and it grinds away the high spots in the terrain. Is that right?
That's right. It grinds away the high spots. And when it hits a low area, all this material being pushed ahead of the glacier, if there's a low spot, this heavy rock will just fall down and the ice will drop out and the ice will ride over it. So it tends to fill in the low spots. And when it hits a hard or resistant ground, because this advance has happened many times in the past, each advance wears the high spots down a little bit. When we look at our region, the area around the Straits and Whidbey Island.
But look at the oyster catchers coming in. You hear that high-pitched noise? Oh, I love them so much. They want to make sure that they get in the recording.
Great.
Anyway, so Varn, sorry to interrupt, but
quite all right. they're great to see.
They are.
So this action of the glacier in our area, as it arrived here, it dumped a lot of the soft material into the low area, that's where we were, and it backfilled some of that. And as it moved over, It left some sediments, probably ground away other stuff, but about halfway down the Quimper Peninsula, we run into harder ground, and we can look at the rocks like Tuonamus Rock around Anderson Lake or around the area around Eagle Mount. We're seeing these much older, harder sediments. And when the ice hits those, it's trying to grind them up and tear them away. So you can look at many of the rocks. You can look at the nice slick rock formation on I think the east side of Anderson Lake, and if you walk out and look at that, you'll see the drag marks where the glaciers drug across that and scoured it.
Oh, cool! I'll have to look for those more carefully next time I'm out that way. So what happened here then as the glaciers receded?
As the glacier begins to melt back, in our area, where the glacier went out the Straits of Juan de Fuca, that was a very large, fast-moving mass of ice. And the ice that moved down through the Puget Lowland, the Puget Lobe of the glacier that went by our area, it was a little slower moving, and it was melting away at the toe. So there wasn't near as much ice there. So that melted back first, and that left a lot of water trapped in the ice as the ice continued out Puget Sound. And so we ended up with a lot of water and melting ice trapped right here. And then as the Strait of Juan de Fuca lobe started to melt back and break down, that resulted in flooding here, where large amounts of water flowed back this way, some of it under the ice, even forcing through at pretty high pressure. And that scoured channels in our area. And that was one of the major features that determined where the low areas would be cut or eroded away, that would later be filled with the sea level. During the major part of glaciation, sea level was much lower. But also, there was another result of the glaciers here, and that's that the weight of the ice resulted in the ground actually sinks or it lowers just under the weight of the ice. There were over 2,000 feet of ice in the Port Townsend area. So the sea level is controlled by the huge mass of ice in the continental glaciers. So it's a little slower melting. So after the ice receded here, the continental glaciers continued to melt, but sea level would have been very low at first. But sea level began to rise fairly rapidly then after that, as the continental glaciers melted. And the land was still suppressed by the weight of the ice. It comes back by a process called elastic rebound, where it springs back as the ice melts. That happened much slower. So the water came in fast. Sea level here would have appeared to have been higher when sea level reached normal. And then the ground slowly came up a little bit. As sea level stabilized at its new level, the action of wind and wave erosion took over as being the major erosive force in our area. And that's the force that really altered the landscape to what we see today.
And those sediments that the glacier had left were generally soft, so then they're subject to wave action and erosion. Is that right?
That's right. Some are softer than others, and we'll
get to that. I guess
I should
say relatively soft.
Yeah, we'll cover that in a little more detail when we get on to the sediments. But in terms of the landscape, when we look out at the island and we see the islands with this nice smooth top surrounded by bluffs, those bluffs, there was already a low area there that may have had channels, or we don't know the shape of it, but it's the action of wind and wave eroding into the shoreline that formed the sea level bluffs. So we've gone from ice being a major force to flowing water being a major force, now to the wind and wind-driven waves being the major erosive force that's changing the shape of the bluffs, and that's a dynamic process. If you go out on the beach, you see this incredible high energy environment, but it's really the waves at high tide eroding the base of the bluff that's oversteepening the bluff and driving erosion. It's the nature of these glacial sediments. So if you look at Whidbey Island or a Protection Island, where you see the fairly low angle bluff, a smooth surface all the way to the top, those are soft sandy sediments. And where we see the stronger tills and more cemented material, and then we see a more vertical bluff, like in the areas, some of the areas around Port Townsend.
Uh-huh. And I should interject that some of these things are difficult to imagine, like the glaciers coming in and where their boundaries are. But there are some great illustrations of some of these processes in Ray Troll and Kirk Johnson's fabulous book, Cruising the Fossil Coastline, which came out a couple of years ago. Ray has these great illustrations, and it shows, the northern, the Cordillera ice sheet that comes down from the north and where the boundaries were against the mountains, and like all the undercutting of the channels that were rivers underneath the glaciers virtually. So you probably have a copy of that book.
Yes, and at Fort Worden there's a kiosk down by the Marine Science Center that has maps that show about how the ice moved and describes a little bit of this coastal geology too. So you can look at that while you're standing right there looking at the view.
Yeah, it helps to have illustrations sometimes. Since this is radio, we can see and imagine, but it's nice to be looking at a visual while you're imagining these things that happened so many years ago.
Absolutely.
Varn, when we look at the bluff above the beach, what are the types of sediments we're seeing? Is it all glacial?
Much of the sediment we're seeing is glacial or glacially related. Once again, to go back to the end of the Pleistocene, this big continental glacier was staying fixed up to the north, or not melting back as fast. But as the weather warmed and cooled, and the ice down in our area advanced and receded many times, and each time was a different stade, and each what
when
we call
a stade. When you're saying stade, what do you mean by a stade?
A stade is an advance of the ice. So as we're standing here, anytime if we were in an interglacial period, then the ice advanced over us and receded back to another interglacial period. That would be a stade.
Huh.
Each advance and retreat of the ice, each stade, as you would, brings with it a similar series of sediments. Now, all of these sediments don't get left behind. But if we were standing here during an interglacial or non-glacial period during the Pleistocene, as the ice advanced, we would see a series of sediments that the glacier deposited. Now, not all of these got deposited on every stade, but as the ice advances, remember, it's melting. And it's carrying a lot of sediment, ground up rock, with it. So as the advancing ice melts, the water runs out of the ice and it carries with it a lot of the sand and finer material that runs ahead of it. And that deposit is termed advanced outwash. And that's very commonly as loose, soft sand. So if you look at some of Protection Island or Whidbey Island, those soft slopes, a lot of that's advanced outwash.
And till is heavier material generally.
Right. So as the ice continues to push, this finer material gets pushed ahead of the ice or washed out ahead of the ice, But the water flowing out of the ice does not have the same capacity as ice to move material. So the glacier is just like a dozer. It's pushing all this ground up rock and a whole mix of material with it. That's really what till is. Usually contains a real mix of material. And as the glacier advances, ice rides over the till, it compacts it. And so a till is looks a lot like concrete, these early stage tills. And they're a mix of material. They cement together very well, and it makes pretty good solid ground. And so if you look at the really steep or near vertical bluffs, they're commonly composed of till. And you'll see these mix of large boulders and cemented together with fine material, and that gives the glacial till a lot of strength. As the glacier is advancing, it makes these real competent tills, but then when the ice starts to melt back, there's a lot more water, and it separates the till better. It washes the fines away. And so it leaves a coarser material behind. Well, we call that ablation till. So the water's melting, the fines are being washed away, and the till that's left behind can be more sorted sometimes. It may contain much less fines, or you'll see some that's almost grated that will be mostly cobbles or pebbles, depending on the energy of the melting. And kind of the ultimate ablation till is to look at the top, if a whole river channel can be cut down through the ice, and that will result in an esker, which is just a big pile of kind of loose material. And we'll talk a little later about where you can see some of those.
Oh, and I'm sorry, but I can see that we're running out of time for today. You will all have to wait on the edge of your seats for another month to hear Varn define what an esker is.
Varn, thank you so much for coming in and sharing all your expertise with us here on the beach.
It's been totally my pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
And to Nora for being our faithful, patient, cold field recorder and editor.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a double-crested cormorant. Isn't this a cool grunting, belching sound? It sounds more like a pig rooting around after tubers than a bird. Right after we finished with the recording for our geology field trip, Varn's wife, Karen Lull, joined us after her beach walk and was telling us about an unusual belching sound that she heard a double-crested cormorant making as she watched it fishing. We then started discussing whether we had heard them make this sound before. And when I got home, I went to the Great Macaulay Sound Library site curated by Cornell University and trolled about to find this wonderful example of the sound that Karen had heard. By the way, you should all go to allaboutbirds.org to search for other great sounds yourself. It's a terrific resource. Meanwhile, Varn and Karen had posed the question online to some other naturalists in the area and got a very informative answer back from Bob Boglehide, who had studied cormorants off the coast of California. He says, quote, "Cormorants can be fairly vocal, mostly quiet grunts, growls, coos, and moans, but you don't hear them very often away from their nests. On the Farallon Islands, where we studied brants, pelagic, and double-crested cormorants, they all made sounds around their nests. These sounds are occasionally heard in large fishing schools when taking off or landing or in mating or territorial displays, but you don't hear them much away from nesting colonies. Karen should consider herself lucky," unquote. We also get the same three species of cormorants here off our coasts. The best way to tell the double-crested from the other two is to note the orange facial skin and throat pouch in both breeding and non-breeding season, and the thick neck with its pronounced crook when in flight. It is the most widespread cormorant in North America, and the term double-crested comes from their appearance during the breeding season, where the adults develop an additional tuft of feathers curving back from each side of the head behind the eye, which is usually white in birds along the West Coast. Males also attract females during the breeding season by performing a conspicuous wing-waving display that emphasizes their colorful head tufts and neck. All species of cormorant often stand in the sun with their wings spread out to dry. They have less preen oil than other diving birds, so their feathers can get soaked rather than shedding water like a duck's. Though this seems like a problem for a bird that spends its life in water, wet feathers probably make it easier for cormorants to hunt underwater with agility and speed. And that's it for Nature Now for this third week of March. Thanks very much to our guest, Varn Brooks, and to our faithful sound engineer, Nora Petrich, and to you, our radio audience. Please mark your calendars to hear part two of the show around this same time next month. Closing music is Bring Me a Little Water, Sylvie, from the wonderful group Sweet Honey in the Rock. As always, happy trails.
Bring me a little water, Sylvie. Bring me a little water now.
Bring me a little water, Sylvie.
Every little once in a while. Bring me little water, Sylvie. Bring me little water now. Bring me little water, Sylvie. Every little once in a while. Can't you hear me calling you? Can't you hear me now? I need a little bit of water. Every bring it in a bucket, Sylvie.
Bring it in a
bucket now. Bring it in a bucket, Sylvie. Every little once in a while. Sylvie, come running, bucket in her hand. I will bring you water.
Can't you see me coming now?
Can't you see me coming?
Can't you see me?
Can't you see me now? Can't you see me coming? Every little once in a while.
Bring me a little water.
Bring me a little water.
Bring
me a little water now.
Bring
me a little water.
Dungeness River Nature Center is pleased to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature. Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.